Good evening and happy Shabbat to everyone. It's my pleasure to be with you. I'm Yana. We have both Larry and JB here, and I think even Kirk is going to join us later in the program. How are you, fellas?
Good.
Doing good. I'll keep an eye out for Kirk on the
Okay, terrific. Terrific.
That's what I was looking for.
Yes, terrific. I want to have one closing comment on what we were preoccupied with last week and to some degree even the week before. And then, as promised, I thought we would spend this evening translating Bamidbar, which is in the wilderness, Numbers 6, beginning at the 22nd verse where Yah was introducing the subject and the and this particular blessing to Moshe. It's Yahweh's statement. It's not Aaron's statement, as it is referred to in Christianity. And then going through it together, I want to use all the tools we have available. I will discuss why I think it is helpful for us to translate it together. But here's one last closing comment on last week. I learned almost immediately after our show last week that the expert who provided the contrarian view, over-the-top view, grossly exaggerated, condescending view of the translations that I provided for everyone's consideration in Dabarim 12 regarding food was a fellow that is well known to many of us who have been part of this journey for some time. He is not a professional. He's not a scholar. He is easily the most divisive, misleading, condescending, babble-speaking irritant that I've had the displeasure of meeting along the way. Had I known it was him, I would have simply mocked the entire approach. Now, that said, I'm going to give Larry, is there anything you would like to add to that, or are we just dusting off our sandals and moving on from these idiots?
There's nothing. I read his translations. I got to tell you, his translations were so bad.
Yes, they were horrible.
They were so convoluted. They were so weird.
Weird.
That
yeah.
A person could get more out of tearing the papyrus up,
yep,
throwing it in the air, and describing how it hit the ground. And I mean that.
Yeah.
It was
awful. I think you could read the phone book and glean as much from it as you can from his attempt.
It said nothing.
Attempt.
It said nothing insightful. There was not one piece of insightful information other than the fact he probably hates you.
Yeah,
other than that, there is nothing else.
Yeah, he's preoccupied with trying to bring me down for no other reason than to lift himself up. He has a narcissistic personality. We talked about that on Shattering Myths earlier today. And he is a textbook narcissist.
There are several in that group that call us the pork eaters. Now, this is very funny. And they were doing this on Sonia's page, which is a health page, by the way. Sonia does not eat pork.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Cherie does not eat pork.
Oh, yeah.
Nearly anybody in there. I, Larry Hendricks, said, I will eat a baby back rib every now and then and a BLT.
Yeah.
And I'll have pepperoni on pizza. That's what I said. You know what my main diet really is now? Oatmeal and whey protein and almond milk and whey.
That's
my staple.
I don't eat much pork. I hadn't previously. But I'll tell you that after this experience and knowing that Yahweh provided us with this exemption and understanding the basis of his teaching and having a really good, close, personal relationship with him, I will eat more and more pork just because it's the right thing to do under these circumstances. They have made a religion, literally made a religion out of what they think are laws regarding diet. And I think it's repulsive, personally. I mean, I think it is idiotic, moronic, repulsive, absurd, and if you want to be told what to do, if you want to have your liberty restrained, if you want to be obedient, have at it. But you're not in a relationship with the same God that I've come to know.
Well, I'm trying to figure out why somebody picks one
right,
of what they call a law. I just don't get that. I don't understand.
Oh,
I don't understand.
The same, well, no, I understand. I understand. This is the only part of this that is actually worth discussing. It's the reason behind the exemption. It's the reason Yosha said, eat what's ever set in front of you. It's the reason Yosha said that a man is not defiled by what goes into his mouth, but what comes out of his mouth. There is a reason for all of this. And that is that man prospers religiously from a God who is fearsome and who has laws to be obeyed. And coming to know how to obey him is the stuff of religion. Rabbinic Judaism is predicated on kosher. If you study Rabbinic Judaism, you will learn that the single most important thing, the foundation of Rabbinic Judaism, was trying to complete what they perceived were the inadequacies of Hashem's instructions and rules regarding diet. And so they created rabbinic arguments to complete his deficiencies because he did not provide enough information for you to obey this as some sort of a standard. And so that became the argument that justifies in the religious mind Rabbinic Judaism and the Talmud, that you have to have these things or you can't eat kosher. And so Yosha recognized that if his disciples, if we today, were to restrict our diet and tell people, no, I can't eat that, I won't eat that,
it would look religious.
Absolutely. It would look like we are part of Rabbinic Judaism. There's a reason
he didn't
say anything about turning anything that was put before him down, because he didn't want to look like he was practicing Rabbinic Judaism. And he doesn't want us to look like it either, because it undermines the whole message of the Torah.
You know, one of the things that I want to point out here, you know, this was a thought I had in the midst of all this debate. You know, Yahweh goes to great lengths to talk about circumcision. I mean, great lengths. He developed, you know, a
of
whole
the spirit
series
and of the flesh, right?
Explaining
whole series
its
purpose, explaining what it represents, explaining why he asked for it, explaining when to do it. I mean,
and here's another thing I will add.
Over something so small.
Right. And this is something I will add.
And forever, by the way. You know, circumcision isn't something you confront on a daily basis. It's a once and forever.
Yeah. And this is just something I want to add, too. And this is for all times, all places, all generations.
Right.
There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it.
Yeah, by the way, and
but
the basis of eternal life, the basis of being engaged in the relationship, the basis of salvation, the basis of entry to heaven, you can't enter heaven, you can't engage in a relationship with Yahweh, you cannot be have eternal life or be saved unless you're circumcised. So it's really important.
And he makes a great effort to stress that, just like he does his name, just like he does his Shabbat, on and on. Now,
right.
one thing I want to point out is because he does not live in the flow of time as we know it, I think one of the reasons he laid that down was for Paul.
Oh, I agree.
I really do.
Yeah, I agree.
I think he said, I got a way to get you for anybody that really wants to listen in the event that they're, you know, confused. Here's what they can go to. And I think he's doing the same thing with the food instructions. And by the way, when he gave them the
The circumcision instruction was to undermine Paul's credibility for anyone who cared to observe his word. And
so that was your
thinking,
too.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
Fine as well.
Yeah. He's so detailed on circumcision. And circumcision is one of the very few things that he says it's of the flesh. I think it's the only thing he says is of the flesh and of the spirit to completely undermine Pauline doctrine. And he says it will preclude you from each of these three things. No covenant, no relationship, no entry to heaven, no salvation. So it's clearly being stated that way to undermine Pauline Christianity. But this food exemption is being stated this way to undermine rabbinic Judaism.
That was my thinking, too. And if somebody said
I don't think
to me,
any question about
they,
it. I'm certain of it.
I'm seeing the whole thing, and all he's knocking religions down. Tear their buildings down. Tear their pillars down.
Right.
Forget their names. You know, the whole bit.
And the advocates
know,
of don't eat pork that were citing Isaiah, Yashaya, they cited the boiling pots of pork from a chapter.
Easter.
That it,
from
that
Easter.
Has, right. That has only one theme, and that is his lambasting religious practice. And so it happens to be that he's attacking Easter, the Easter ham. And the Easter ham, by the way, preceded the Christian Easter. It's devoted to Ishtar and the celebration of Tammuz being gored by the wild boar and them eating the boar while weeping for Tammuz during what is now called Lent in the 40 days celebration of the impregnation of Mother Earth. I mean, that is the context of that particular discussion, and it's that's what you said when you first heard it, and you're right.
Yeah, that is right, and you know when I've been called an abomination now. I'm teaching people how to become an abomination. What these people have done is they've actively worked to subvert people from seeing the truth.
Correct.
And their truth seems to be wrapped up in one, obeying one law. And the rest of the laws, I guess, can go to hell because they don't obey them. They can't. You know, so I'm a little set back. I thought these people were a little more mature than that.
I did too.
They're not getting this. When I meet a person, I do not say, you know, and I'm considering that we might engage in a relationship. I do not say to that person, "What do you eat?"
Yeah. You know, by the way, when I tell people. Because people will find in my home things that would indicate that I'm Torah observant. Like, for example, I have developed a real appreciation for matzah. I really like matzah. I mean, I really like this stuff.
You
I
like matzah,
matzah
you're right.
Homemade.
I've got two cartons of matzah. I like the slightly salted version of it is my favorite. And I have matzah every day. Now, you know, I'm going to celebrate with matzah during the week-long celebration of Pesach Matzah Bekodim. But, I have it there. And when I tell people, and they'll say, you know, are you Jewish? And I say, no, I'm Torah observant. Well, did you eat kosher? No, I don't eat kosher. No. I'm Torah observant, and I'll, you know, in fact, I can be Torah observant and have a BLT. Absolutely, unequivocally, without any concern, demonstrating what it means to be Torah observant.
Well, Fred makes a good point. Obey the laws of the land. does the land make laws? The answer to that is, of course not. And also, if you're out in the wilderness, you know, for 40 years, and I tell you not to eat pork or shellfish or crustaceans, whatever, and, you know, I'm talking to you 3,500 years ago, out in the middle of the wilderness, who said that's for all time?
Right.
I mean, what? Who said that?
Yeah. He didn't. You know, actually, when it comes to food, Yahweh has many evolving instructions because circumstances change. What did he tell Adam and Chawa?
They were eating the fruit on the tree.
Fruit of the tree, man. I got the fruit of the tree.
Through,
so they're
go
dying
through
with
all
food.
Of them.
They didn't eat meat because there was no dying. You can't eat meat unless the critter is dead.
In Eden. That's right.
So in Eden, the instructions were fruit. And when they left Eden, what were the instructions? What was Adam going to have to do? Till the land, right? Do you
yep.
till the land to create bunny rabbits?
No.
No, do you till the land because you want to create hamburger?
No.
No. You till the land to grow vegetables. So they left from having a fruit diet. It was immaterial what they ate. They were immortal. They were perfect. Fruit tastes good. And they went from there to being principally vegetarian. And from there, they as they were leaving, and when they were in Egypt, they ate whatever they were able to eat just to survive as slaves. And when they left Egypt, he fed them matzah. You know, matzah.
Yeah, so we're now we're into grains for sure.
Yeah, well, actually,
no
it was kind of a that. Kind of a sugary, sappy, almost like bread-like secretion that Yahweh formed. It's called mach. You know, what is this? Is really what it was called. And you know, what in the world is this stuff? But it definitely wasn't on the "this is good for you to eat" list, and it wasn't on the "bad for you" because Yahweh doesn't mention vegetables. And he mentioned vegetables once, then never mentioned them again. He has ongoing instructions about what you should eat that pertain to the time that you are living in. If there was one universal theme, it's don't be religious. So, you know, if the Easter ham, dating back to the practices of Babylon, you ought not do that. And he's also saying that, you know, if an animal was sacrificed to a false god as part of a religious ceremony, don't eat that. That's not good for you.
Use your head.
Use your head.
Yeah.
Don't eat that. Use your head. All right. You know, and all we can do is we can present what God says, as he said it, as accurately as we can, and then make the connections, hoping that people grow and understand. And, you know, if you don't want to, that's okay. And if you don't want to eat lobster, you don't like shrimp, you don't like pork, then don't eat it. But be careful in your choices and situations so that you do not convey the idea that by being Torah observant, you're like the rabbis. Don't do it in a way that causes someone else to misunderstand the liberation that's associated with the Torah. That's all I would say about it.
Because you're not trying to lead people into a religion full of laws. You're trying to show them that the Torah is a document that leads to freedom. Those are two opposing views. That's what I have tried to tell these people.
Right.
That, you know, most of the people in this debate do not eat pork. Okay? Most of them don't.
I understand that the things on that list were for most of human history dangerous to eat, and that there is still some residual risk associated with some of those animals. And if you choose for dietary reasons not to eat them, don't eat them. But don't be religious about it. And don't imply that you're not doing it because you've been restricted from doing it by the Torah, because that will give the wrong message.
That is the point here. That's what we've been doing all these years.
Right.
And yet these people are now actively working to subvert all that work. That's
right.
Actually what they are doing. They've got a little group now where they sit around and talk about us and hate us and call us a bunch of swine eaters and this and that and the other thing.
And go ahead.
Which isn't even true, by the way.
Go ahead. Don't care. The only reason I wanted to mention this is to destroy the credibility of the criticism of the translation. Now, I'm not telling you that translation is perfect. In fact, it's one of the very few times that I have done a translation without a corresponding commentary. And I will probably never do it again. For example, I spent most of today working on a translation, and I shared it with three or four people, but now everyone that I shared it with is listening to this program. Don't share it with anybody. I don't want you to publish it. I don't think I will ever again share a translation without commentary, because what commentary enables you to do is precisely what Kirk talked about on Shattering Myths yesterday. He says, you know, the way you present your translations is you don't say you're right. You say, here are the words. Here is how the words are written. Here's their stems, their conjugations, their moods. This is what the word means. This is how other people have translated this word. In this context, the word is more limited in what it can mean. But out of this context, the word has all of these potential meanings. And here is how I've come to choose the definitions that I'm providing for you. But, you know, feel free to work this through on your own. At least now you know the possibilities and the process. And when you do it that way, you're not saying you're right. You're saying, you know, to the best of my ability, this is as accurate, consistent with the understanding that I have of the way this is conveyed in Hebrew as to what this means. And, you know,
well, you've always said, by the way, when you lay your translations out, I have no particular expertise in this area. I'm not calling myself an expert. In fact, you say it is absolutely impossible to get a perfect translation across.
Impossible.
You put that right out there.
You can't move from Hebrew to English or Hebrew to any language and have a perfect translation. Well, just look at the translation of Yosha's comment about the Mikra, and how that was changed to Ecclesia, and which is a, you know, conveys what 10% of the meaning of Mikra, Ecclesia does, and then they changed it to church, and you say, you know, you lost everything. So, the translation, you lose 90%, and then the replacement, you lose 100%. So,
yeah, and it's intentional too. It's all very intentional.
Your translations really can't stand on their own, in that, like, if you were to just pull all of the translations you've done and compile them, it doesn't stand on your own, because really what you're trying to do in your translation is put all of the insights that you've gained from looking up each word, looking at its root, looking at the other words made with the same letters, and you're trying to put all of that insight that you've learned from that into a fluid sentence.
Right.
And so without the commentary explaining how and why you chose that,
it becomes impossible to read the translation, because there's too much information. So you can present an amplified translation and then, in subsequent or previous paragraphs, explain the process that was used to derive those meanings.
Perfect example of that would be Zarua. That would be a perfect example of that.
Right.
And, you know,
I can't define Zarua in the sentence. But I sure as heck can take the reader through the examples of how Zeroah was first introduced in the Torah.
Yeah,
and what
shouldering
it means.
The burdens and the sacrificial lamb. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, can walk the reader through how I came to that conclusion based upon the Yahweh's use of the word.
And you're right. And you're right, yet nobody will do that. Somebody told me you can't just make things up. And I said, well, let's look at what it means.
You're right.
That's what it means.
Earlier this week, I thought it would be kind of useful if I took and compiled, go through word by word one of the verses, put the word, put all the information that I get in Logos, all the definitions. I did one word. I did the word that's translated as beast. And it was 38 pages worth of information.
Right.
And I was like, there's no way I'm going to be able to do this for an entire verse.
Right.
And make it in any kind of format that anyone can read it, because you're taking information from, 7 to 8 different books, three different sections of those books. I mean, there's so much to go through.
That information is valuable, but the information belongs in the commentary.
Yeah.
And when it's in the commentary, you're helping to enlighten and educate the reader. You're enabling the reader to think for themselves, to test the veracity for themselves, to understand the process, and then go out and do it on their own after a while. Most people don't do it because they're afraid of becoming vulnerable. Because when you do that, you become vulnerable. You say, listen, I'm not perfect. There's no perfect way to do this. I'm just going to explain the process that I went through. And you're free to reject it, accept it, modify it, whatever you wish to do. But here's the process. So you're sharing the entire process that you used, and I think that's helpful. I think that's appropriate. A professional would never do that. If you're a scholar, you've got to have that aura of correctness and association with you. So us amateurs, yeah, we can do that. We're comfortable doing it.
I feel uncomfortable not doing it at this point.
I'm just thankful for the amateurs.
Some of my translations, and the more and more I got into it, I noticed my footnotes went from being one or two a page to being about a quarter of the bottom of the page, just because I was putting my commentary on my translation in footnotes, and it's like by the end of it, it's a quarter of my page is just footnotes on it.
Yeah, see, and I think that the commentary on the derivation of meaning is only one-third of the reason that commentary needs to accompany translation. There are two other reasons. One other reason is for people to understand, you need to help them through the connections. What this means in the big picture, how this relates to other things that Yahweh said, so that you can transition from knowing what he said to understanding what he said, that takes place in the commentary. And if you don't make the transition from knowing to understanding, the knowing is not all that valuable. So the translation is only valuable up to the point that it helps people understand. And so at least a third of the commentary is based on providing insights and understanding. And then there's the next application of it. What is this mean to you and me? What's the practical takeaway here? What is this telling us about who Yahweh is, what he wants, what he expects, what he is offering, how we respond? What are the practical takeaways here? What is he talking about here? And how does that apply, whether it's a prophetic statement of something that's happening in our world today or it's something that he provided in terms of guidance? And so I think that all three of those things are essential to trying to translate what Yahweh said from Hebrew to English and from his mindset and perspective to ours. All right, now, one of the things that I wanted to do today is we're going to go through this Bamidbar, Numbers 6 passage, beginning with the 22nd verse. And you'll never hear the 22nd verse or the 23rd in any church service or any even variation of it because it's way too Yahweh, way too Moshe, way too Torah, way too Word of God for them to even consider including it. There are a number of reasons I want to do this. One is to share with you the process that you go through to create a translation. I want to convey absolutely and unequivocally that this is not a scientific, this is not a scholarly, this is not a professional undertaking, and that nobody has a natural proclivity for it. It's a slow process where you've got to think in Hebrew and then move from Hebrew to English and to try to mesh these very different languages to try to convey the meaning of what's being said. And I think by walking through this together, it's going to be, you're going to appreciate the process, some of the fun that's associated with the process, but also just the realization that none of us are better or worse equipped to do this. It's just a matter of, are you willing to invest the time? All right, that's it. The first word here is and. It's conveyed with a wa. Now, with the Hebrew wa, you have a number of choices. You can choose to exclude it, because in most cases, I suspect that the Hebrew wa is there as punctuation, because there is no punctuation in Hebrew. There's no question marks. There's no periods. There's no exclamation points. There's no commas. And so there has to be a way to say, okay, I finished one thought. I'm going on to the next thought. And there has to be a way of connecting thoughts. And so there are times when the Hebrew wa is there to tell us something important about what follows and to connect things together. And there's other times when it serves strictly as a form of punctuation. When you see the wa, then you say, okay, we're starting a new sentence or we're starting a new clause. Now, James, you do a fair amount of translation.
It's like a German in some cases.
It's like a what?
It's like a period at the end of a sentence.
Yeah, like a period.
It's at the beginning
yeah.
of a sentence in Hebrew.
Right. Yeah, it tells you there was a period now. Let's start with a new sentence. Almost all new thoughts begin with the wa. Okay. The wa in Hebrew means to secure. I'm going to go through this process, and I'm also going to share the pictographic depictions. And I'm going to do that because our good friend Kirk is become quite the celebrity on Shattering Myths. I get more positive feedback on Kirk's and his illustrations via the pictographic letters in Hebrew than I get on anything else. I mean,
yeah, where can we contribute to give him a salary to make him the permanent co-host?
Oh, he is spectacular.
I can donate a little money on that.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, he has just called in right on cue.
On cue. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, hi, Kirk.
How you doing? Good evening, y'all.
Good evening. So, the wa in Hebrew, it's drawn as a tent peg, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And it conveys to secure and enlarge. Now, it's to secure and to enlarge and to connect are just partial aspects of it. The tent peg was specifically used to secure and enlarge one particular thing. What was that thing?
The family home, the tent.
That's right, the family home. And the tabernacle, which is the family home of God.
Right.
So, the wa conveys to secure and enlarge a home and a meeting place. That's a rather important symbol, right?
Yeah, very.
So, wa. To secure and enlarge a home and meeting place. He elected, now this, the next word is debar. The subject is he. It's a prefixed subject. Okay? It's important because we've had quite the running debate about prefixes and suffixes. In Hebrew, as is the case in many languages, conjunctions, like the wa, are a letter before a word. And in Hebrew verbs, most of the time, there is a prefixed subject and often a suffixed object to the verb. In this case, it was third person, singular, masculine. So it's presented here as third person, masculine singular on the prefix. So that would be he elected to speak. Now, I'm not going to do this on an ongoing basis, but on this particular translation, I wanted to start with the word order, the way the words appear. Where do subjects appear in relation to verbs in English, JB?
Before.
That's right. So if we're speaking English, to make the English sentence work in a grammatically correct fashion, we would put the subject before the verb, wouldn't we?
Yeah. So
where does the subject come in a Hebrew sentence?
Usually directly after the verb.
Yep. Almost always. Unless the subject is a prefixed pronoun. Now, the prefixed pronouns, there's a lot of variation in Hebrew. There's first, second, and third person. There's singular and plural. There's not only masculine and feminine, but also common. Common means could be men and women. And so in English, we will use you, but we don't have a, unless you're Kirk. Kirk, you have a you all.
We do.
Well,
we
Yahweh has a you all. That would be second person plural. You all. And the advantage of having pronouns and the like, having a masculine, feminine, or collective orientation, is then it makes it much easier to find what that pronoun is addressing. Okay? In this case, it's pretty straightforward. Third person, singular masculine, is the prefix pronoun, and the subject follows the verb. The subject is Yahweh. So he is Yahweh. I just thought, just to begin this one, we would do it in the order of the words. The word is Dabar. Before we define Dabar, Kirk, using the letters,
right.
What is the picture drawn by the letters for the Hebrew word for word, Dabar?
It's the doorway, S-A D, and then, of course, the B-F, or the tent, and then, of course, the Rosh, which is the head. Or I think, and I always think of it in terms of a thinking head, because you're engaging, it's a head that engages all its senses.
Yep. It's a doorway. The D is depicted as a doorway. How many doorways are there?
There's one doorway to get to this family.
Yeah, one doorway. Okay. So the D is a doorway. The home is also projected with walls and an entrance.
Mm-hmm.
Are there multiple entrances?
No, sir.
No, there's only one entrance.
Mm-hmm.
And then the R that completes the bar, it is an observant person, isn't it? We have
mm-hmm.
eyes, ears, and a brain. So eyes to see, ears to listen, a brain to process, and a mouth to respond.
Right. Not one who obeys, is it? It's an observant.
So the word, Hebrew word for word, would be the doorway to the home for an observant person. The word is the doorway to the home for an observant person. Now, I want you to think about that for a moment and think about one of the most famous lines that Yosha uttered in the revelation to Yahuchanan regarding the Laodiceans, those who he refers to as vomit, who are outside of his home. What does he say? I stand at the doorway and knock. Doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And so he is the doorway. He is Passover. He's the doorway. He is the living incarnation of the Word. If you are observant, you understand these things, that door is wide open for you and you come right into his home. So it's really important to understand. Yeah, the Word is the doorway to the home for an observant person. Pretty
isn't
good
amazing,
start, right?
Though? I mean, don't you find that just amazing?
Yeah, I do. I do.
I mean, that's so cool.
Yeah, I know. You know, I almost feel like I'm being a bit childish when I say it's really cool.
Well, no.
You know?
Well, a kid can understand it.
Right. So Yahweh's word is the doorway into his home for an observant person. So, that's the definition. Okay. So we have to now translate Dabar. Before we begin with this Hebrew word that means to speak the word, we have to look at the stems. Now, stem establishes the relationship between the subject and the object. Then we have to look at the conjugation. We have to look at the mood. All right? So Dabar was written in the peel stem. Now, I'm going to tell you that coming to understand the stems and not having to look them up is something that takes time. It's not hard. It's just like everything else you do. If you do it repetitively, you think about it, and you look it up, and you write it down, and then you look it up, and you write it down. After a while, you kind of get the feel of it. So let me tell you what the peel stem means. The peel stem, the subject, puts the object into action. It is it's the subject is influencing the object under the auspices of whatever that verb is conveying. Okay, so in the peel stem, the subject is putting the object into action and influencing the object by the connotation of the word itself. Now, do we have a peel stem in English?
No.
No. Would it be appropriate to ignore the fact that Yahweh conveyed this using the peel stem? No.
No?
So it would not be appropriate to ignore the fact that Yahweh conveyed this via the peel stem, and we do not have a peel stem. We don't even have any stems in English. So now the transition from Hebrew to English requires some a considerable number of additional words to convey what the peel stem is indicating. And the only way that you can convey the subject puts the object into action and influences the object. The subject is influencing the object based upon the meaning of the word, by that word, by the action of the word. The only way you can do that is to add words to the definition of the word to convey this is what is happening. And if you don't do so, you're not conveying the message completely or accurately. All right. So it was written in the peel stem where the subject, Yah, is influencing the object, putting the object into action, and that's Moshe. Then it was written in the imperfect Wah consecutive. Now, I want to apologize here if those of you who called in and listened in tonight think this is way too detailed and you were looking for something, you know, more inspiring than a systematic review of the words and Hebrew grammar. I want to say we advertised we were going to do this today. I think this is fun. I think others think this is fun, and I apologize for those that just think this is way too detailed. Hebrew scholars will tell you this particular construct, the imperfect wa consecutive, conveys past tense. I think they're wrong. Now, I'm going to tell you why I think they're wrong. First of all, there are no tenses, past, present, or future, in Hebrew. Hebrew verbs are all unrestricted in time. They're all liberated in time. So why would there be some odd construct to take a particular form of a verb and to constrain it to time? It's inconsistent with the very nature of Yahweh and inconsistent with the language he created. That's my first argument. My second argument against the scholars is that this particular form is written in the imperfect, not the perfect. The imperfect cannot be constrained to time, which means it cannot be past tense. Everything in the imperfect is ongoing. It's forever. It's always. You can't constrain something that is ongoing to past tense. So it would not be in the imperfect. If he wanted to convey past tense and something that happened in the past, it would have to be in the perfect. Now, the perfect doesn't mean that it happened in the past. It just means that the action is complete. The action can be complete in the future, the present, or in the past in Hebrew, but it means the action is complete. You can't have past tense of a non-completed action. So he would not have used the imperfect. If he wanted to restrict a verb in time, he would use the perfect.
That's a good point. Right. Not me.
All right.
Yeah, clearly. We're talking about something that hasn't been done yet. So,
right. Right.
You know, how can
right.
you...
Right. Yeah, and by the way, yeah, he's talking about something that he wants Moshe to do.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's pretty clear. So you're telling me the Hebrew scholars would say right. this was already done before it was done. Well, that's
yeah, he was,
just a beautiful
he was,
thought.
He was having a present tense conversation with Moshe about something he wanted Moshe to do in the future. There is no
clearly.
Past tense. In this context, you can't get past tense in that. Now, the other aspect of it is the consecutive.
Hmm.
The consecutive is an expression of volition in Hebrew. The consecutive conveys volition. So, you know, why remove the volitional aspect of the consecutive? Why remove the purpose of the wa conjunction? Why convolute the purpose of the imperfect to create an impression that Hebrew has a past tense but no other tense related to time? So, that's why I personally, this is the advantage of commentary. I'm trying to walk you through why I disagree with the scholars. I'm telling you what the scholars say, and I'm telling you I disagree with them for those reasons. And, you know, we've all been given brains. We all have a nesama. We can all think this thing through on our own, and you can come to a different conclusion. You're not going to offend me. All right, so the subject, Yah, is influencing Moshe. He's trying to put Moshe into action. This is an ongoing request, something that's going to have an ongoing benefit, never-ending, imperfect, and it's under the auspices of volition, free will. So here was my attempt to translate Dabar, the doorway to the home for an observant person, the Hebrew word for word, with it being imperfect, ongoing, putting the object Moshe into action, and consecutive under the auspices of volition. And the consecutive is very similar to the cohortative. It's a first person expression of volition. What does volition mean? Free will, choice, decision, desire. So the will of a person, the desire of a person, what a person wants. So here it is. And of course, it was written in the third person, masculine singular, where he is the subject referencing Yahweh. And he elected to speak the eternal word to influence Moshe. So Yahweh, he elected to speak the eternal, ongoing, because imperfect, word, Dabar, to influence, peel stem, Moshe. Elected, chose, wanted to, desired. Because of the consecutive mood. So, and Yahweh, to secure and enlarge the home and meeting place, Wah, and to secure and enlarge a home and meeting place, Yahweh elected, expressing his will and desire, to speak the eternal word to influence Moshe. Now, that is a completely amplified translation that conveys everything that I think is given to us regarding this word. So you could say he communicated using words to endure forever as to call us to action, expressing his eternal will by verbally sharing that which is always transforming. That would also convey all of the subtleties that were attached to this word.
Yada, when you use the pill and it's not a past tense, is there what I'm confused on what, you know, because all the books will always use that as a...
Well, the peel doesn't refer to a tense. The peel is a stem.
Okay.
The wa, imperfect consecutive, scholars say, is past tense. They actually don't say it's past tense. They say could be used to convey past tense.
Okay, okay.
And it was my analysis that you would never use the wa, because wa also means then, now, you know, at this time, you know, it's next thing that happened was. So you wouldn't use the wa. You wouldn't use the imperfect because it means ongoing. It's not constrained to a prior time, not a completed action. And the consecutive is an expression of volition. So that's the I rather than take the scholarly approach.
Yeah.
What I chose to do, thinking through the process. None of which applies to the peel. The peel is just the stem that operates independently of all of this. The peel is one of three of the most common Hebrew stems. The single most common Hebrew stem is the call, Q-A-L. The call says there is a literal relationship that is genuine and actual between the subject and the object. Okay, that's all the call stem does. It means there's a genuine relationship that is a literal and actual relationship between the subject and object. Just plain speaking, straight up, you know, it's what is your favorite way of conveying it, Larry? The only straight game in town?
Yeah,
oh, that's what the call conveys. This is straight up, straight game. Interpret it literally. This actually happened, or as something that's actually happening, or will actually happen. This is a literal and genuine statement that expresses an actual relationship between the subject and the object of the verb.
Okay.
That's the call. This was not written in the call. The second most common Hebrew stem is the hiphol stem, which has the subject influencing the object, but in the case of the peel, it's a little bit more passive. It's more calling the subject. Like a great example of the peel would be Larry drove the car. You put the car into action. You influence where the car went by you driving it. That would be the peel. So the peel is the third most common Hebrew stem. Does that help, Kirk?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm very slow with this, but
okay. Yeah, and the peel has nothing to do with the time. It has nothing. It's not a tense. It's a stem.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then, as it relates to time, you have the conjugations. The conjugations don't speak of time in the sense of being limited. They speak of time as either this is a completed act in the past, present, or future, or it's a ongoing, something that's ongoing that continues throughout time. Okay? And then there are a variety of different moods. The moods are trickier in that there are, every mood conveys volition. But some of the moods convey volition in a little different ways. Like the imperative is a really emphasized form of volition. JB and I were discussing the paragogic nun. And scholars are all over the lot as to what the paragogic nun means. But almost everybody says that it expresses something that needs to be emphasized, that you should pause and consider what has just been said, and that it expresses something under the auspices of volition or free will. And so it's volition that is being emphasized, that it would be a good place here to pause and really think about what is being conveyed, the paradox of none. And there's a first, second, and third variation of volition in Hebrew. Okay?
Sure.
So, and Yahweh elected to speak the eternal word to influence Moshe. Kirk, I want to take a shot at Moshe and what we can learn about the name from the letters that comprise it.
Oh, gosh, well, I didn't look it up.
Okay. The Mem. Yep, the Mem is what?
Mem, of course, is water or covering, protection, cleaning.
Right, cleansing and the source of life, right?
Mm-hmm.
By the way, where was Moshe drawn out of?
He grew out of the Nile, out of the water.
Yeah. Is the Nile comprised of water?
I think so.
Yeah. Yeah. Does the water of the Nile give life to the land?
Yes, indeed.
Yes, indeed. Does it cleanse the land when it rolls over the land? Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Okay. So Moshe, which means to draw out, was drawn out of water, and the first letter of his name is water. So that's a pretty good start. I rather like that. So water which cleanses and brings life via the shin in Hebrew. The shin in Hebrew. Yeah, you've seen the shin before?
That's the teeth, nourishment, language.
You betcha. Right. So water which cleanses and brings life via the word.
Right.
And then the hay in Hebrew.
And the hay, of course, is the male or female. In this case, it's at the end, so I guess you would almost say it's feminine. But the hay is a person looking up, humankind looking up, reaching up to God.
Yeah, reaching up, standing up,
looking up right.
to God. Yeah, the all of those concepts. So the hay means in Hebrew means to observe, to be observant, to notice, and it's a person standing up, reaching up, looking up. Okay, so Moshe's name, water which cleanses and brings life via the word to those who are paying attention. Pretty good name, right?
Well, remember that it's also ready to walk. It's going to do a lot of walking here in a minute.
Right, yeah, it's one who draws out. If you're going to be drawn out and away from something, what's the most typical Hebrew means of conveyance if you're going to... When Yahweh begins the covenant with Abraham, what did he say to Abraham?
He said, walk with me.
Walk away.
Walk away.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, walk away. Yeah, in fact, it's halak is walk away. And it's interesting, halak begins with the person standing up walking, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The first letter in walk.
Yeah,
is the hey, person standing up and walking. And not just standing up and walking, but reaching up and looking up to God as they walk.
Yes.
So they're walking aimlessly.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty good, isn't it? And the L in Hebrew is actually the same shape as the L in English.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a shepherd's staff. So who are we walking with?
We're walking with the shepherd,
right? Who protects and nourishes his sheep, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's the H and the L of halak. And so then you only have the K, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the K is what? It means an open
K is
palm.
Palm.
Right,
palm.
An open palm. And it says two things. It's to welcome, to greet, three things. To welcome, to greet, and to embrace. All three of the very similar kinds of concepts. But it means to welcome, to greet, and to embrace. It's also, because it's an open palm, it means to open a doorway, to open a passageway. So halak in Hebrew is to stand up, reaching up, and paying attention to God, being guided by the shepherd as he welcomes you and embraces you. That's the Hebrew word halak, walk.
Why did they kill this alphabet?
I don't know. This is a really good alphabet, isn't it?
And I do have a question here for you guys.
Yes. Go ahead.
The Shin and Moshe, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is it a Shin that we're using for the S there?
Yes.
It's an S-H. Yeah, okay.
I'm wondering why it's eat, consume, destroy on the pictorials that I've always looked at.
Oh, well, there is a reason. Brenner, who is the guy that's most famous on the Internet for putting together his pictorials. In fact, I just had a lovely email from a gentleman who will be listening to the archive of this show, who is translating the Torah using the pictographs. And the guy that that provided the site that provides most people with their pictographic information is Brennan's site.
Okay.
I think Brennan means well. I think his research is reasonably thorough. I think that that his research has value. I don't think Brennan knows Yahweh. I don't think he understands the covenant.
I don't think he can. I like the guy's information and stuff. He's one of my sources. But I look at it through different eyes than the Christians
look
at it. And he's telling to them. I'm just looking at it. All right, what's the oldest thing meaning that they used to? I got five different angles I come at it from. And that's one of them.
Yeah, and I, by the way, I took a different approach, Larry. So if you want to know why. My open palm, or the shin. The shin is the letter you were looking at. The shin, which is two
right.
D, which,
and I've heard you say open palm before.
Right.
But the shin makes it teeth only.
I define shin, teeth, as the word. First of all, almost everybody will begin there. Let's say it means word, and it's to provide nourishment. But I don't go any further than that, because the moment you go beyond that, you're going beyond what I know about Yahweh. The word of Yahweh nourishes. Full stop. You know, sometimes I can tell, let me just give you an example. When I was in sales initially, I was really lousy at it. And so I used to come up with my long list of attributes for a product. And what I always found is whatever my weakest point was, if I had 10 points, the person I was presenting to would challenge the weakest point. Same thing was true in a debate when I was a debater in school. That they would always attack my weakest point. And so I figured, you know, there's a way to avoid that. And just stick with the three strongest points. The three points that you're absolutely certain of, give those and stop there.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a stronger case, a stronger argument. And so with Shin, words that nourish. Full stop. I don't see any reason to go beyond that.
Yeah, I think you're right. Okay. I mean, I'm all for that. I mean,
okay.
Consume words that
right.
nourish. That,
oh,
that
yeah.
would work.
Yeah. Right. Now, I do want to interject here. We've said this a bunch of times, but I feel like I need to continually repeat it. I'm walking you through my thought process. I'm telling you the reasons that I made certain choices. I'm not trying to sell you on the choices. I'm not trying to justify the choices. I'm not trying to convince you that my choices are right. But you ask a question. I love this stuff. I've thought about this stuff. This stuff really means something to me. I'm passionate about it. And so I've taken the time to think about it. And these are my conclusions, like, for example, the law imperfect consecutive. I walked you through. I've read what else they've said about it. I just disagree, and I've shared the reasons why I disagree and what I think what it conveys. And you know, you're free to disagree or free to augment that or challenge it or whatever you wish to do. So I'm not telling you that the others are absolutely wrong, but I am telling you that when I apply it as words which nourish, I'm in really good position in terms of being consistent with Yahweh's overall teaching.
Well, it's very consistent. He says that all the time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're absolutely safe there.
I'm safe there. I don't want to go any further because I know I'm safe there. And that's enough for me, by the way. Finding his words nourishing, I'm good with that. That for me is big. I don't, why add something to something that's already profound? Okay, so Moshe. Moshe means one who draws out. It's from Mashah. You know, it's interesting here that that even my attempt to de-Greek Moses, you know, Moses, which has the oos ending to make it work with the Greek grammar, it's based on the Hebrew verb Mashah. M-A-S-H-A-H. So, Mem, Shen, He. The likelihood of it being Moshe is zilch. It's would be Mosha, and it's and you know it's an S-H, not just an S. Now I'm going to tell you, I don't think there's enough merit in the different pronunciation of his name once you know what it means for me to spend the next 200 hours editing all the books to change it, but. The fact is, it's based on the verb mashah, which means to draw out. Okay, so and he elected to speak the eternal word to influence. This is Yahweh elected to speak the eternal word to influence Moshe. Now the next two words are la amar. Okay, la is a preposition. Its primary meaning is to approach. That's its primary meaning, is to approach, to draw near. It's law. And then amar, which means word, promise, answer, declaration. So let's begin by trying to analyze what the letters convey. So to approach, and it's a singular letter as a preposition that's attached to the verb that precedes the verb, a letter, the lamed. Mm-hmm. All right, my friend Kirk, you're on the spot. What's a lamed?
To move towards, to lead, direct, teach, and protect. Isn't that what a shepherd's staff is?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
He's pretty easy. Now, this is good.
Yeah. Yeah, this is really good.
Good tip. Good tip.
But
thank you.
Okay, now. Let me share something with you that I think is fairly profound. Yahweh uses law at times where he's speaking of, you know, if you observe this and answer the invitation and respond, you're going to come into my presence. He uses law as if it's an actionable concept where you're not just, you know, a lot of people write law according to Yahweh. Mm-hmm. And I've changed that. When I see law, I will say to approach Yahweh. Because the primary meaning of the L-A preposition prior to the word isn't according to. It's to approach. And so almost everything he's saying is designed to enable us to approach him. Now, is that creating an actionable verb out of a preposition? Yeah, I suppose. But is it accurately conveying the meaning of the preposition to move towards? I think so.
And that makes him approachable, and as Larry always says, you know, he's not something to fear.
No. So, have you ever seen a sheep with a caring, diligent shepherd where the sheep are afraid of the shepherd?
He won't be able to round them up if they are.
Right. Does the shepherd use the staff to punish the sheep or to keep the wolves at bay?
Keep the wolves at bay and to pick them up and get them out of a hole or something
right.
like that.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And the staff is a walking stick, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Because they're off on a journey together.
Right.
And with that walking stick, he takes them to rivers to drink and grassy fields to be nourished, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
That's a marvelous metaphor, the shepherd's staff. One of my very, very favorite metaphors. The law is nothing more than the shepherd's staff. Okay, amar. So after we have the shepherd's staff, which is leadership and authority, we have amar. Now, amar is... I shouldn't have said leadership and authority because that's the aleph, the first letter in Hebrew. It means leadership and authority. So that's the first letter of Amar, which means to say, to declare, to promise, or to answer. Like the promised land in Hebrew is the Eretz Amar, with Amar changing from a verb to a an adverb. So the promised land in Hebrew is, you know, to promise in Hebrew is Shabbat, the basis of Shabbat. But yet, the promised land is Eretz Amar, the land of answers, the land of declarations, the land of promise. So it's not just promised land, it's the Eretz, the land, the realm of Amar, which means to declare, to answer, to promise, to say. So where was the land that Yahweh communicated to us? Israel. Where's the realm that Yahweh is going to continue to communicate to us? His home.
Israel?
His home. Yeah. And is Israel the place you would go for answers?
Yeah. That's where a source of information or salvation flows, in Jerusalem. And right in the heart of it.
Yep. So this is to Moshe, to approach by saying, La Amar, the shepherd staff, leadership authority, and the A, the Alpha of Amar. And then the M?
Once again.
Cleansing, life-giving water. Right?
Cleansing water and protecting,
And the Rosh, the last letter of Amar?
Mm-hmm. It's still the head, the thinking head, as I like to call it.
Yeah, the observant and thinking head.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, La Amar would mean the shepherd staff to guide and lead with authority.
The observant.
Cleansing, cleansing and providing cleansing and life-giving water to those who are observant. This is the shepherd leading us by still waters. This is the shepherd protecting us, leading us, guiding us. What does the Torah mean? To guide. You know, this is, Amar is a really important word when you look at it, and when it's to approach through this promise, through this declaration, through this guidance, through these answers, it's, you know, again, I want to say, wow, that trips my trigger. That really excites me to have the word that beautifully explained. So to approach by saying, it means to draw near and to come toward through communication, to call, to promise, to intend, and to answer, declaring. This puppy was written in the call. Okay, Kirk, I know that the stems are not your favorite.
No.
But what does the call stem convey?
Something special to think about. Is that the... that's the paragoric, isn't it?
And it means this is literal.
Literal.
There's a literal, genuine, and actual relationship between the subject and the object. So he is... this is Yahweh speaking to Moshe and telling Moshe to approach by saying the following. So there, that means that between Moshe and Yahweh, there is a genuine and actual relationship which should be literally interpreted. That's what the call stem means. Then it was written in the infinitive construct. The infinitive construct means that Amar, to say, to promise, and to answer, is a verbal noun. We don't have verbal nouns in English.
No, not that I'm aware of.
No. But there are verbal nouns in Hebrew. The infinitive construct denotes a verbal noun. That means the noun is actionable. That means the promise is a verb. That means that the answer is a verb. What's the difference between a verb and a noun? A verb conveys action. A noun depicts a thing. So a noun depicts a thing, describes a thing. A verb depicts the action. So a verbal noun is a very descriptive thing that is put into action. So to approach Yahweh, his promises provide the way. His answers enable us to approach him. That's what that means. Now, you can't translate it that way and everybody think you're saying, but that's what it means. That's what it means to have written an Amar as an infinitive construct. It means that the promise is actionable. the answer is a verb, which means that it's something that is that God is providing for us his answers for us to approach. So that's a pretty good first sentence, wouldn't you say?
That's let them get that out of the King James.
Yeah. So and to secure and to enlarge a home and meeting place, he elected to speak the eternal word to influence Moshe. This is Yahweh. To approach by saying, and then here's what follows. That was 6:22. Speak to prompt a decision for Aaron and to his sons to draw near by communicating this demonstrative frame of reference. And then we'll talk about what follows. But let's first, how did we come up with that? All right, the next word is debar again. All right, Kirk. Debar, three letters. What do they mean?
Doorway.
Yep.
It's the home, and for
yep.
the observant or the one who shemars, thinks.
So the word is the doorway to the home and family for
mm-hmm.
observant individuals.
Right.
Debar.
Because of the Rosh being ahead. Looking.
Right. The Rosh being the head depicts a person with eyes to see, ears to listen, a brain to process the information, and a mouth to respond. You know, the observant person is not a toadstool. You know, observant person isn't a rock that's sitting on a stump. An observant person, that's an actionable concept.
Mm-hmm.
They're engaged.
Yeah. Well, that's where so much of the doing comes in. I mean, when we're doing this, we're actually participating in the Torah.
That's exactly right. We're participating in the relationship. We're having a conversation with God.
We're observing the Torah. That's
correct.
What we're doing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
So this says, speak to prompt a decision. Now, why did I come up with, speak is obvious, it's debar, which is the doorway to the home for the observant individuals. Communicate to others under the auspices of free will, sharing the transforming word so that those listening might elect to engage in communication, which is designed to elicit a response, an active response based upon what is spoken. So obviously all of that character and flavor I got from the stem, the conjugation, and the mood.
But
so go ahead.
Sorry.
No,
I was going to say, there's no place that you can find where Yahweh is talking where he's not asking you to make a decision or some action.
Right.
I mean, he talks to Abraham, has come out.
Right.
You know, so I don't think that's a real stretch.
No, and by the way, he's trying to influence us. That's what he wants to do.
Yeah.
What does a dad want to do when he's teaching and guiding his children?
Mm-hmm.
What does a mom want to do when she's providing guidance to her children?
Well, she's looking to get them to make a good decision.
Right,
you know.
To prepare them so they can make good decisions in life, so that they can exhibit moral character, you know, to do the right thing for the right reason, right? So that she's trying to influence. The peel stem says, I'm trying to influence in a way that has a positive effect on my child for listening, and that will... is very much actionable because it's not a passive form of influence. It's an active form of influence where you're trying to enlighten the individual or influence the individual so they are put into action so that they respond to what you're sharing with them. So that's the peel stem. So you've got to say that this he's speaking for the purpose of influencing and for motivating the individual to act. So how did I come up with the decision? Well, this was written in the imperative. Imperative is an expression of free will. So, written in the imperative, so we have to say, so he's trying to influence Aaron. He wants to put Aaron into action, and it's being stated as a choice, a free will choice for Aaron, which, by the way, means...
Thus, you said he spoke to prompt a decision.
Right. That's the only way to convey all of those thoughts that I know of in English.
You could say he spoke to properly guide them, possibly. Right. You know, you
now, you notice here
too.
I did not say on an ongoing basis, because this was not written in the imperfect. It wasn't written in the perfect. This did not have a conjugation. So it doesn't say speak one time and, you know, like what's the movie Red October, one ping only, Mr. Vasuli. You know, this doesn't say just do it once. And it doesn't say do it on an ongoing basis. So how often an ad, this is not being stated. It just says, I want you to speak in order to prompt a decision. Or in a, you know, another way you could say that, communicate to others, and this is to Aaron in this case, under the auspices of free will, sharing the transforming word so that those listening might elect to engage in communication which is designed to elicit an active response based upon what is being spoken. Peel, subject puts the object into action, influencing the object, imperative, expression of second-person volition. So second-person volition. He doesn't say to Moshe, I want you to want to. I don't want you. He's not telling Moshe, you know, under the auspices of free will, pal, you make a decision. He's second-person volition. He's trying to elicit a decision, a choice, on behalf of the object, the second person, who is Aaron.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, I am certain that some of this, for those who haven't engaged in trying to render Hebrew sounds complicated. These are really, it isn't. It's really simple thoughts. But I also want to convey the fact that that to convey these simple thoughts, you do have to think about it, because you can't get from Hebrew to English without adding a lot of extra words.
Most people think it's as simple as looking at a word and looking at what those words could mean and just writing that word down. But there's thought that has to go into it. And this is the problem I have with professional theologians. Since none of them, by their chosen profession, none of them could really understand Yahweh's nature, or they wouldn't be in that field.
Right.
They do not render thoughtful conclusions. I mean, they just don't. And I mean, you can read them time and time again. And if a person doesn't take Yahweh's nature into account, forget it. The translation is going to be mucked up. It will probably make no sense by the time it's done.
Right. You know, for example, debar. Debar as a verb means to speak. Right? To communicate.
Mm-hmm.
But what it, as a noun, exactly the same word, written exactly the same way, with exactly the same three letters, what does debar mean as a noun?
Just word.
Word. So wouldn't it be appropriate to say, speak the word to prompt a decision?
Mm-hmm.
Which is why the amplified version of this, it says here, communicate, which is debar, to others under the auspices of free will, sharing the transforming word so that those listening might engage in communication, which is designed to elicit an active response based upon what is spoken.
You could just as easily describe the tablets of stone as the 10 words.
Well, of course, that's what it is, exactly
what
it is.
That's what they're described as.
Well,
that's
you don't have to be real elongated about it. You can just say 10 words.
Yeah,
I would say statements, but...
Yeah,
for me, in my English brain, I say statements too, but I mean, just to...
But it's the 10 words, not in the sense of there are 10 words.
There are 10 statements
containing words. You know, the words is plural here. It doesn't say how many there are, but there's 10 statements, communications, conveyed via words.
But that should demonstrate to everybody how much work you go through to put these things together. I mean, this is, you know, I know you don't need a pat on the back all the time, but boy, this is deep stuff, heavy stuff.
There is a lot to it. There's a lot to it, but the closer, the more observant you are, the, I mean, that's what I wanted to share here, is that I want to share a lot of thoughts, and you know, we've come into the end of our program, and I hope this was meaningful enough to enough of you who are listening to this and participating in it that you don't mind that we continue this next week, because there were lots of reasons for it. One is to say there is no definite right or wrong. This is you're forming a relationship with these words and their author. This is not a clinical scientific exercise.
There's a lot that is as much science as it is art.
Correct. And for those that have will make a statement, you can't translate it that way. No, they're wrong. You really got to be really careful on what you say can and cannot be done. You really need to think it through.
You cannot translate Kodesh as holy.
No, you can't do that.
There is no way to get holy from Kodesh. You cannot do that.
No, you can't do that. Not be accurate.
You can't just replace a word with another word.
You can't replace Yahweh with the Lord and be accurate. I mean, there are wrong and there are right, but for the most part, this is like relationships. And in relationships, there's not a lot of black and white. Relationships, you know, are thousands of shades of billions of different colors. And this is the most. The Hebrew words provide, Kirk, I think you know this. The Hebrew letters that comprise the Hebrew words is this massive, magnificent, and brilliant palette of colors and shapes and hues and intensities, all of which collectively work together to portray the most beautiful individual ever known and the most wonderful story ever told. And it's in these colors and in these shades and in the perspectives towards them that we deduce the meaning. And it's an exercise in communication. It's an exercise in relationship that this happens. It's about engaging in the process, participating in the conversation. I mean, that's why we're walking through it. This is how you have a conversation with God.
Well, you know, another 5 years from now, you could add another 3 or 4 paragraphs in it because we had thought about it a little bit more, just like in Yada Yada. I mean, how many pages now was it compared to the start?
Right. Of course. With every character, with every stroke, with every thought, with every moment of observance comes more understanding.
You're right.
And it's powerful. You know, for example, that's the first time I ever thought about the Eretz Amar as the realm of answers, the realm of the promise, the realm of the declaration. I never thought of it that way before. I had never bothered to think about this preposition law that moves toward where I finally rendered my translations rather than according to Yahweh to approach Yahweh. So I at least got that part more accurate, but I never thought that, wait a minute, the whole concept is being presented by a shepherd's staff. And on all the implications of that. So you're right, just every time you go through it, you learn something new. That's what eternity is going to be like. What we're doing here now is an expression of what eternity is going to be like. We're just examining the words and the Torah. And this, of course, brings us to a very important name. And the name is Aharon. It means enlightened free will.
Mm-hmm.
All right. The first letter is the LF. Kirk?
Mm-hmm. The A.
Yeah.
That's the Almighty. Is the strength. Is right. The head of the house. Is
right. Ability, authority, capability, power.
Is where
right.
Power.
Right. Uh-huh. And the horns. The horn conveys several things. One is a ram uses a horn to protect not only himself but also the rest of the herd. Right?
Sure.
If you're a mountain lion and you're trying to feed upon the herd, what are you going to encounter from the ram?
It's going to go after you
with the horns, right?
Absolutely.
Right. And when Yahweh speaks of teruah, which is to be a troubadour, to trumpet out his word, blow out a message on the trumpet, a warning and also an invitation. What was the ram's horn used for?
That's the trumpet.
Right, the trumpet. And lastly, since Yahweh is is king, this is his universe, which makes us royalty as his children, which is pretty cool. A king has a crown, and those crowns were most commonly made of
horns. Yeah, in the early
horns.
Days. Yeah.
Yeah. So the ram's horn conveys leadership, conveys protection, conveys power and ability, an authority, royalty, a royal nature. The first letter in Yahweh's title. All of those. But it's interesting that in this particular case, the horn is on what animal?
Well, it's usually the ram on this one.
Yeah, it's a ram. And what is a ram? Is that not a male lamb?
That's male lamb, and that's pretty symbolic in itself, yeah.
Yeah, what was the...
just a little.
What was the... When Yahweh took on human form, what did he become?
He came as the Lamb of God.
Yeah, the sacrificial lamb, the Passover lamb.
Sacrificial lamb.
And so in this particular case, this shepherd isn't lording it over his flock. He's
no,
one he's, with his flock, isn't he?
Yes. He's brought the rocking.
That's a humble God. That's a God that's engaged. That's a God that says, you know, I want to be... I want you to be like me. I want to be like you. I'm not trying to be this, you know, awesome thing out there that you can't relate to. This is a shepherd that's part of the flock. Now, that's not the way most people want to perceive God, as a shepherd that's part of the flock. But he is. That's what he is conveying through this letter, which is the first letter in his title, El, and it's the first letter in his title, Father.
That's also the number one, too. One in, as in one and only.
Yeah, it is. It's Av is the... Yeah, yeah. Aleph is, means one. One only, singular and first.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the first letter of Aharon. The second letter is a Hey. So this is leadership, ability, and authority for those who stand up and pay attention, who reach up. Who are, now the next letter is the Rosh, who are observant individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And the purpose is the law to secure and enlarge the home and family.
Which is
Now this is the first time we've come across the nun.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the nun's one of my favorite letters.
Yeah.
You know what nun means?
Yeah, it's the continuation, the inheritance, the family.
The
group,
child with an
you know,
inheritance.
It's a seed. It's a seed.
Yeah.
So it's
the child with an inheritance. It's a picture of a little sperm, but it's not any ordinary sperm. This is a child with an inheritance. Do you know of some children with an inheritance? There's a godly club that he formed. For
that's called
with
the
an
covenant.
Yeah, you got it. There you go. The nun talks about being born into Yahweh's covenant family and receiving the inheritance that comes along with the covenant, which happen to be the five benefits of the covenant. So, that's what Aaron means, man. Aaron is the leadership, ability, and authority for those who stand up and pay attention, reaching up, observant individuals who are made secure in the enlarged home as newly born children with an inheritance. A pretty good name, huh?
Mm-hmm.
And it, in Hebrew, if you take the two components of the name, it means enlightened
free will.
Yeah. It's on behalf of the... So, El Aron means on behalf of the Almighty. El is the shepherd's staff and the Aleph, the ability... to lead, to protect the authority of the shepherd. So it's on behalf of the Almighty, regarding enlightened free will as a representative God to as one who is chosen to bring light. So that's where we are.
And of course, the A and the R, the R and the Rosh, is also light.
Correct. Correct. So that's kind of a good stopping place. We'll pick this up at this place next week.
Well, thank you for letting me tag along.
Yeah, this is fun.
Oh, I enjoy the pictorial while we're going through the actual amplifications. It's a help.
Yeah. Well, I think what it does too is that for someone who is listening, you say, okay, there is a process. There is some thought that goes into this. There's a lot more to it than is superficial. There's a relationship being established here. There's a volitional picture. There's choices to be made.
He calls it his living word for a reason. You know,
right.
I mean, it's yeah. You know, this is a huge undertaking when you start breaking down words and really looking at them. As much as we wanted to, what did we in an hour and a half cover 7 or 8 words? I mean, you know,
right?
We didn't go a long way. I mean, that's just the way it goes in this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
When it takes.
But what would you rather do? Would you rather just cursory come up with one potential meaning for 1,000 words and to read 1,000 words over an hour and a half? Or would you rather take 8, 10, 12 words that came directly from Yahweh's lips and to say, this is the full implication of these words and names. This is what they mean.
Well, the latter of the two, it would definitely be the appropriate way to.
We could have done what they do in churches and just spend 5 minutes, read through these verses, and then sit here and give our opinion about what they meant for the next hour and a half.
Yeah.
Well, that too.
That's what you get in the church. You get about 5 verses of actual scripture and then the pastor's opinion on what you should do.
Hey, you know what I didn't do here?
People want that. I can't stand it. But
yeah, I think this is more fun. I think this is more useful. I think I would rather spend all night trying to understand a word or a name that was spoken to enlighten us, to liberate us, to instruct us by Yahweh, than I would read 1,000 words about something else.
Mm-hmm.
Can I, before we go, can I at least make an attempt at Yahweh's name?
Sure.
Since I dealt with it the same way. Yahweh's name. Outstretched hand. Person reaching up. Safety and enlargement. The idea of being made secure in a home. Person reaching up. Those are the letters that comprise the name. It's the hand of the eternal existing one, because we've told it's based on Haya, to be. The hand of the eternal existing one reaching down and out to those standing up, engaged, looking up, paying attention, and reaching up to him so that they can be made secure in his home under his protection, increased in every way. That's a definition of Yahweh based on the letters that comprise his name. Let me read that again. The hand of the eternally existing one reaching down and out to those standing up, engaged, looking up, paying attention, and reaching up to him so that they can be made secure under his protection in his home, increased in every way. Yod Heh Wah Heh. Or you could just replace it with the Lord.
Not in my house.
Well, you can do that if you have no interest at all in coming to know him or anything he had to say.
Yeah. If you want to twist him to make him a religious deity, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. I'm not going to go down that path.
He's not going to come down and slap you for doing it. He's just not going to, when you come to the door of his house, he's going to say, no, go away.
You know, there was a time, JB, where I would cringe when I'm sure that wasn't a very funny joke, but, Kirk laughed, but Kirk and I have a good relationship, there was a time I would cringe and say, don't take that out of context, I'm just kidding. And you know something? I don't do that anymore. Yahweh has a sense of humor. And if he, if we didn't say it, he was thinking it. Jesus, for you, of course, you could exchange all that meaning, which I intended, and just replace it with the Lord. And I, you know, I actually see well, laughing right along with us. I do. I think he has a sense of humor with his kids. So I maybe I'm wrong, but I'm comfortable now kidding with him. You know, I was today. I was just thinking about this, what we're going to do tonight, and I was going to say that. That the bottom line here on all of this, because I'm nobody special, I am an amateur at this. I don't claim that what I'm saying is you should take it as absolute. In fact, I'd say you shouldn't take it as absolute. That I would say that what I wanted to share is the single most important aspect in this process for me is that I like him and I like what he has to say. I know like is not a very strong word for many people. But I do. I like him. And I like what he has to say. And so that's why I'm passionate about it. That's why I try to make it as consistent with the God I've come to know and like.
I also
the difference
think
between
one
liking
of the saddest
as well.
Things you know, that ever gets done is trying to attach and prescribe religious notions to Yahweh. This is a sure way to die. I mean, it's just awful.
Yeah. Yeah, wait till we get to you know, some of these other words as we go down through this, and you get the sense that Yahweh wants to be approached like the when we come to the Hebrew word shalom, and how really shalom is about friendship and companionship. It's about friendship and companionship. You know, you like your friends. You like what they have to say. You like what, you know, doing things with them. You enjoy that. I'm happy with Yahweh. I like him.
That's all I'm saying. You choose your friends. You know, that's Yahweh. We choose Yahweh. You know, we're not born to Yahweh. We're not stuck with him because, you know, like, you know, that's family, so you're stuck with them. You know, we choose him.
I like listening.
Well, that's where you get stuck with the command. He commanded you to obey this law nonsense.
I like spending time with him. I like listening to him. I like learning from him. I like the stuff that he likes. I like what he's offering. And I like using the word like because it conveys just how friendly the relationship is.
Yeah, as opposed to the fraudulent, I love you,
But I do love him. But the fact is,
I
like him.
But
I
doubt
if
we'd reduce him to a Hallmark moment.
Yeah, I like
there
being around him. I enjoy
love
it.
That I don't like.
Right. This to me is fun. I think
and you were
likable, approachable.
And you were making his likeness.
Yeah, we're made. Oh, that's true. We're made in his likeness. That is true. Likeness, yeah. Yeah. Maybe it's. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, you know, I was going to say, I like him because he is like me. That's true in the sense that he made me like him, so he must be like me.
Well.
And even with all of our flaws, I think Dode was marvelous at this. Dode liked himself, even though he knew he had all those flaws. I think if we don't like ourselves, if you have a negative impression of who you are, you know, the religious thing, oh, woe is me, I'm such a, you know, a undeserving, blah, 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 blah. Why would anybody want to spend somebody's time around somebody who is miserable, who has a negative impression of themselves? I mean, Yahweh created us because he enjoys being around us. That makes us pretty special.
Mm-hmm. Well, isn't that part of Paul's problem? He was nothing. He knew he was nothing. He just hated everything. He hated everything. Yeah,
he was a complete and utter narcissist.
Paul's really problem was if he wasn't the center of the attention, he didn't want it. And that was it. I mean, he was all about Paul.
Yeah, narcissist. Making false claims, false associations.
Yeah, very grandiose. Talk about grandiose. I mean, I thought
textbook
was grandiose.
Yeah, I had IQ share why he come to the conclusion that Muhammad was a narcissist, and he went through all of the attributes. And I said, you know, while you're listening to this, I want you to also recognize that what he's describing applies to the President of the United States, Obama, and it applies to Paul, the founder of the Christian religion. Narcissism, every aspect of it. It was a brilliant thesis that he presented today. Narcissism gets
I heard that, by the way. Yeah.
And by the way, I'm going to give you one other narcissist, Satan.
Oh, just a little. Raise my thing above your head.
Oh, absolutely. Associated with Yahweh, I want to be considered above the Most High, making all sorts of false claims, has to be the center of attention, as the Lord.
Yet in the world, he's lifted up the highest, isn't he?
In this
world today, he's lifted above Yahweh.
Right.
They don't even know Yahweh. They hate his name. They
lift up Satan. Paul was a narcissist. The popes are narcissists. Muhammad was a narcissist. Hitler was a narcissist. Akiba, the founder of Judaism, rabbinic Judaism, a narcissist. Look at Hadrian. I'm going to make a temple to myself right here in Jerusalem and rename the place after me. Wouldn't you say that's narcissistic?
Yeah, good luck with that, buddy. I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, good luck with that. Yeah. Yep.
I thought your breakdown on God as a title / noun, Gad, was very good. I appreciated that. There's a couple of people that run around and their whole reason to exist is to knock the word God.
Right.
Yet they use words
they
like faith and law and obey.
Yeah, that's the one law they view that as a law, that you can't use the name of a pagan god. That they view that as their one law to obey, and that is their entire fixation. It's just like the people with pork. That is their one fixation. They just can't even seem to get
beyond.
Well,
first of all, Gad was the name of was a tribe in Israel. Come on.
Correct. That's why you sent it to me. And they said, you can't use God because it's the name of a pagan god. I said, no, it isn't. It's not. It was preceded by the definite article. Names are not preceded by the It was so in the context that it was presented in Yashayah. It was preceded by the definite article, which means that it can be a title, but it cannot be a name, and it just happens to be the name of one of the 12 tribes. So you think that Yahweh deliberately
named one of his tribes after a foreign
god? Own rule, and he had one of the 12 tribes named Gad?
No,
turn Gad into a pagan god that you can't say, and therefore you can't say God, why was the tribe named Gad? I just don't get it. Why would you be fixated on that? And by the way, I get so many hate letters on that.
People won't even consider. It's like a one-trick pony with those people.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And by the way, they've never considered what you just shared. They never considered it.
No.
Because they've never looked at it.
No.
They just go, okay, you could say that of Lord. Yes, you can. You can absolutely. That's Baal's moniker, period, end of story.
Yeah.
But you cannot say that about Gad being, okay, well, that means God, and therefore that's a pagan deity. No, he used it as a title / noun, right? The God, and then I forget what the name was, but it meant a fortune. But he named the name.
Yeah, it was good fortune. And what's interesting here, it's the it says the good fortune. It is the GAD in Hebrew. It means good fortune. And what it's really talking about is, at least in my conclusion, is it's the charis. It's the gratia. This is the faith through salvation and the gospel of grace, of good fortune, of grace, of favoritism, of good fortune. And so in that context where he is demeaning the Easter ham, he is also demeaning the gospel of grace.
Yeah, that was Manny was the the actual name.
Oh, there was another. There was a god's name listed after the title of good fortune, which would be the Gospel of Grace, used as a title. And that god was Manny, and that is destiny. And so what it's saying there is that God finds it repulsive that people are saying that your destiny is established by your faith in this gospel of good fortune of grace.
Really?
It's a condemnation of Christianity that
is
being presented.
Yeah, oh. Straight up.
Straight up. It's a straight up condemnation of Christianity is what it is.
Yeah,
and there is no,
and there's
no reference
that wanna...
to a god named Gad.
Yeah, that's
that?
Exactly
that
right.
From?
Yeah, where was that?
That's
that
in Yashayahu 65:11.
Yeah,
and,
but you have to read the whole thing in context to understand what's being said. But yeah, that was you would what Larry had done is that people were because there are more people who are fixated on the use of God, and they want you to use Elohim as like
or say
Elohim,
mighty
what
one.
I'm going to do here.
Say mighty one,
going,
which you
yeah.
couldn't even say mighty one. You'd have to say mighty ones
right.
because Elohim is plural.
Yeah, I know Elohim means mighty ones, and Elohim is used almost universally as opposed to El. And so they want you either to render it in a nonsensical, inaccurate way. Or they want you to not translate the title at all and render it as Elohim, as if we're going to talk about the whole thing in English and then leave this one word suddenly in Hebrew, as if the word were important, because the word's not a name. Elohim is not a name. It is simply a title.
He talks about false Elohim, so he doesn't look at it
right.
as a particular
correct. He uses Elohim
title.
To talk about false gods, so he certainly doesn't have a problem with it being used as lowercase and uppercase God. But people get so fixated on it that is because it's the single instruction. You know, the name of the pagan god should not be memorialized on your lips. And what Yahweh is talking about there is. He's not saying don't say their names, because Yahweh says their names all the time. Baal is used as a name, for example. And Yahweh is using, like Manny, he's using the names. He uses the names of false gods all the time. He talks of the Asherah. So Yahweh is constantly using the names and talking about false gods.
Yeah, he's outing them. He's outing
exactly.
them.
And so by following his example, by learning from his instructions, we too can use those names. I can say Allah. He says
sure.
Allah. I can say Jesus. I can say Jesus is a false god. Dionysus is a false god. Allah is a false god. And so he's not saying that you can't say the name. He just says don't proclaim them in a fashion that memorializes them, that shows them status and favor. That's what he's saying.
Yeah, what he's doing is guiding us away from people that speak religiously and thus guiding us
right.
away from religion. Because
right.
every
right.
five words out of their mouth is faith or fidus
or attributing
sacred.
A false name to him. He's saying don't. The primary instruction is don't attribute another name to me.
Yeah,
my name is Yahweh. Do not attribute another name to me. I don't want to be called by the name of some false god. I'm just not going to say
yes, but
that.
At the same time, he is guiding us away from religious speak, and
yeah,
thus away from religion. I mean,
because the names of false gods are all part
it,
of religion.
You know, gospel. If I hear gospel, you know, if people add any idea what was really coming out of their mouth, well,
right.
they must. It doesn't bother them because I've shared it 100 times, and I still see people that say gospel. Well, they're just the walking dead. You know, if that's what they want to buy into, then, you know, go ahead. You know,
it's a free
will thing, but you're going to be dead.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's no matter where you turn, if you're thoughtful, if you're observant, if you're willing to invest the time, if you make the connections, if you seek enlightenment through this communicative process of examining the Word with Yahweh, then you'll be enlightened. You'll be enriched. Be empowered. You receive all the benefits of the covenant. And you'll have a good time doing it.
Yeah, this is certainly fun.
Well, I think it's fun. I think it's fun. So we're going to continue this next week. The same cast of characters. We'll continue it next week. And I hope that those who are listening benefited from this and thought that this was as much fun and as useful as we did.
All righty.
All right, fellas.
Good evening. Thank you.
Good evening. Yes. May Yah bless you and enjoy the rest of your Shabbat.
And you.
Good night.
You too.
Good night.
See you next week.